Welcome to another AAT podcast on employment issues, where today I will be talking about the income tax and Class 1 National Insurance Contributions treatment of termination payments. This is a particularly relevant issue for AAT members in practice who advise employers, directors and employees, as well as the many AAT members that work in industry and commerce and also have to deal with the difficult issue of people losing their jobs. It is a difficult issue, and these are difficult times, with unemployment expected to rise and many more redundancies anticipated in both the public and private sectors of our country, as employers are forced to make cuts in staffing levels. Well, let me start by giving you my view on what is a termination payment, and forgive me for perhaps stating the obvious. A termination payment is any payment made by an employer when a director or employee ceases to be employed. This may be as simple as the employer making a final payment of salary or wages where the employee works through the notice period and income tax and Class 1 National Insurance contributions are deducted in the normal way. There may be an element of additional payments to cover unused or accrued holiday pay and perhaps bonuses and commissions already earned by the director or employee. That is also a simple situation where income tax and Class 1 NICs should be deducted in the normal way. All of these payments mentioned so far should go through the payroll and be included in gross pay and on the form P45 that the employer must give to the employee on leaving or shortly thereafter if the payroll run is made after the employee has left. The termination payments that cause most concern and that attract most attention from HMRC employer compliance officers are the payments made gross without deducting pay-as-you-earn income tax and Class 1 NICs. Perhaps the biggest mistake made by our clients or our employers is to assume that the first £30,000 of any termination payment is exempt and therefore no deductions are made. It is important to remember that a termination payment is only within the exemption provisions of Section 401 of the Income Tax Earnings and Pensions Act 2003 if it is not otherwise chargeable to income tax. The contractual payments that I have already referred to, if dressed up as compensation and made gross without deductions, would result in a failure to operate pay as you earn, and the employer would be liable to pay the income tax it failed to deduct, plus the Class 1 NICs, and interest and penalties. Employees who are made redundant in these difficult times should be entitled to a minimum payment of statutory redundancy, which I will explain in more detail, where the payment can and should be made gross and free of deduction of income tax and Class 1 NICs. Some employees may receive additional compensation on leaving, which if it comes within the exemption provisions of Section 401, will be exempt, but only up to the maximum of £30,000. There is no exemption for Class 1 NIC purposes. So what we have to do is make a decision as to whether the termination payment falls within the definition of earnings for Class 1 NIC purposes, in which case Class 1 NICs will be due on the full amount of the payment. Alternatively, if our decision is that the payment is outside the definition of earnings, there will be no NIC's liability no matter what amount is paid. There is no limit. Next section, redundancy payments. Employees who are made redundant with 2 or more years continuous service have the right to receive a statutory redundancy payment. The definition of redundancy in Section 139 of the Employment Rights Act 1996 is as follows. An employee who is dismissed shall be taken to be dismissed by reason of redundancy if the dismissal is attributable wholly or mainly to the fact that his employer has ceased or intends to cease to carry on the business for the purposes of which the employee was employed by him, or has ceased or intends to cease to carry on that business in the place where the employee was employed, or the fact that the requirements of that business for employees to carry out work of a particular kind, or for employees to carry out work of a particular kind in the place where he was so employed, have ceased or diminished, or are expected to cease or diminish. Now, I appreciate that's a bit of a mouthful, and you might need to go back and listen to it again. But what we're talking about is, has the job gone? Has that employee's job gone? If that is the case, they've been made redundant. That definition should be applied whether the redundancy payments are statutory or non-statutory. Employees made redundant with 2 or more years' continuous service have the right, therefore, to receive a statutory redundancy payment. The payment due under the statutory redundancy payment scheme is based on the employee's age at the date of redundancy, their continuous service, and here we can only count full years of service, and it is subject to a minimum of 2 years and a maximum of 20 years' service. The weekly gross pay on which the statutory entitlement is based is an upper limit that is currently £380 and is normally increased every February, although the last government brought forward the increase to 1st of October 2009 and there was no increase for February 2010. You can use the statutory redundancy payment calculator on the government's Business Link site, but it is based on the number of years' service and the rate of pay, and as I've said, it is subject to a maximum. For each complete year of service up to a maximum of 20 years, the employee is entitled to a half week's pay. For each full year of service where their age is less than 22, then they get 1 week's pay for each full year of service where their age is 22 or above, but less than age 41. And they get 1.5 weeks' pay for each full year of service where their age is 41 or above. The maximum gross weekly pay is capped at £380, so an employee who only earns £250 a week will get the relevant number of weeks multiplied by £250, not £380. An employee earning, say, £500 a week will be limited to the amount of £380 per week times the number of weeks. Well, in preparing this podcast, I used the calculator on the Business Link site. Taken as an example, someone aged 59 with a maximum of 20 years service and earnings of £248 per week. The amount of statutory redundancy calculated was £7,292, made up of 27 weeks at £248 for the years between age 41 and 59, and then 2 weeks' pay at £248 for the 2 years before the age of 41. Someone on £500 per week would have received 29 weeks at the maximum of £380, given a total of £11,020. The maximum statutory redundancy pay that anyone could receive in any circumstances would be £11,400 based on the maximum 20 years of service over the age of 41, given 20 years multiplied by 1.5 weeks at £380. That, of course, would be within the Section 401 exemption provisions, but it would be well below the exemption limit of £30,000. Now, what that tells us is that statutory redundancy pay will always be exempt from income tax, and of course it will never be earnings for Class 1 NIC purposes. Some employers do make enhanced redundancy payments, which I will refer to as non-statutory redundancy payments. Providing they are what they say they are, then they should come within the exemption provisions of Section 401. They will be exempt, but now they are subject to the £30,000 income tax exemption limit. And all exempt payments, including statutory redundancy payments, have to be counted for that purpose. I must add a word of caution here. Be careful that non-statutory or enhanced redundancy payments are what they are described as, and do not constitute a payment for services past, present, or future. A payment made as a reward for continuing to work through a notice period will be taxable. But a payment of enhanced redundancy pay that is subject to being in post on a future date should be within the exemption provisions. I recommend you look at the two examples in HMRC's Employment Income Manual at EIM 13990. That may prove quite useful at some time in the future. Next section, compensation payments. Compensation for the loss of the employment or office should be exempt up to the £30,000 limit in Section 401, but again, taking into account any other payments such as redundancy payments. Please be aware that HMRC will check that the payment is compensation and not something dressed up as compensation, perhaps a contractual payment sourced in the contract of employment. I appreciate that sometimes employers want to try and help their leavers, but if they do this by including contractual bonuses or commissions in a lump sum payment described as compensation, HMRC officers are likely to look beyond the label it's given, and if they discover that contractual payments have been lumped in with genuine compensation, they will be demanding any unpaid income tax and Class 1 NICs, as well as interest and penalties. We also need to be careful of any compensation payment that may appear excessive, because HMRC officers will look for some other reason for the payment, such as a terminal bonus for past, present or future services, or a bonus on retirement. Next, I want to consider ex gratia payments under the heading of compensation. Ex gratia means a payment where there is no contractual obligation, or a payment where the payer does not accept liability. I have always felt that there is a lack of HMRC guidance on this issue. In its National Insurance Manual, it states that NICs are not due if the employee cannot expect to receive it, if it is not normal practice to make such payments, and if it is unconnected with the services. It must not be paid because the individual is an employee, which follows the judgment in the case of Hamlet versus Godfrey, which was the GCHQ case. The fact is that HMRC officers will argue that very few ex gratia payments are not liable to national insurance contributions, and of course to tax also. They will only escape liability if it can be accepted that there was some reason other than the employment. HMRC officers will normally argue that the source of the payment is the employment, not the termination of the employment. I will discuss clearance applications in more detail before the end of the podcast, but this is one type of payment where I would want to consider obtaining HMRC agreement before making any payment, tax and or NICs free. I have seen too many cases where it's been assumed that an ex gratia payment is tax-free up to £30,000, and later that has proven not to be the case. Next, I want to look at pension contributions. Employers may make contributions to a registered pension scheme or an employer finance retirement benefits scheme as part of the compensation package when unemployment is terminated. Qualifying payments should not use up any of the £30,000 exemption in Section 401, because Section 408 of ITPA 2003 removes the Section 401 charge. It cannot remove a charge under Section 62, which might apply if the leaver is already entitled to the payment before the employer contribution is made. However, HMRC guidance acknowledges that arrangements are usually made so that any entitlement to a termination payment that would fall within Section 62 is lawfully waived before the special contribution is made. So that's good news, and it is something I will always discuss with clients in terms of an employer director receiving more than £30,000 exempt lump sum payment, where we might channel some of it into a pension scheme to avoid paying tax and to boost the pension fund. Next, I'm going to look at taxable payments. I've already made some references to contractual payments, which come within Section 62 and are fully liable to income tax and Class 1 national insurance contributions. In other words, where pay-as-you-earn should be operated. A payment is a contractual payment if the employee has a right to the payment. And we must be aware that HMRC will look to investigate this. Officers will ask to see the contract of employment, the staff handbook, appointment and termination letters, and any other documentation related to the terms and conditions of employment. They will certainly be asking for notes of interviews if the negotiations resulted in large compensation payments. They may determine that a termination payment is liable to pay as you earn a national insurance contributions if they see that the payment was sourced in the contract. Garden leave payments are quite straightforward and are taxable as normal pay. Garden leave occurs where an employee resigns or gives notice to leave, and the employer does not want the employee to continue working through the notice period. The employer may also not want the worker to go immediately to a competitor, and therefore sends the employee home, but retains the employee on contract and continues to pay the employee as normal. In this case, the employer must continue to direct pay-as-you-earn and national insurance contributions as normal. Next, you might come across restrictive covenant payments. These are often a feature in termination packages. These are payments of valuable consideration for restrictions on post-employment activities, which might mean a non-competition clause, or a no-poaching-our-employees clause, or a keep-your-mouth-shut and don't-talk-about-our-business clause. Restrictive covenant payments are fully liable to both income tax and Class 1 national insurance contributions. They do not come within Section 401, but are otherwise chargeable to income tax under Section 225 of ITPA. Next, I want to talk about payments in lieu of notice, or pylons. Pylons may be taxable if they're contractual, or non-taxable if paid as compensation or damages for being refused the opportunity to work the notice period. But what is certain is that they will come under close scrutiny by HMRC. Pylons are usually the main target of HMRC officers, seeking to establish that the payments are contractual and therefore liable to tax at NICs. HMRC uses the term auto-pylons and considers that where the payments are made automatically as a consequence of the termination of the employment, they are liable to tax and national insurance contributions. Similarly, habitual payments, that is where the employer regularly makes payments in lieu of notice when an employee leaves, will also be regarded as taxable. Discretionary payments will be taxed if there is evidence of the employer exercising the discretion to make the payment instead of perhaps negotiating a compensation package. HMRC should not seek to tax genuine compensation or damages, so what we need to do is to look at what the payment is and what evidence exists to demonstrate that the pylon is genuine compensation, as opposed to something where the employee has a contractual entitlement. Now I want to look at compromise agreements. A compromise agreement is a legal agreement drawn up on or after the termination of the employment, but usually put in place to avoid later claims from the employees or directors that they might pursue before an employment tribunal or a court. The employee must take independent legal advice, which is normally paid for by the employer and is not taxable. The agreement is used to deal with any and all claims that the employee may have against the employer. It is wrong to assume that all payments included in a compromise agreement come within Section 401, because it may contain some contractual elements chargeable under Section 62, or indeed a restrictive covenant payment chargeable under Section 225. Most agreements will include a clause in which the employee accepts the terms of the settlement in full and final satisfaction of all claims. If no specific sum is attributed to that undertaking, then HMRC will accept that no value is given to it, and accordingly no charge arises under Section 225. When we have a compromise agreement, we need to look at what it contains. We need to look behind any lump sum payment, and we need to look at what contractual entitlements might be rolled up into the amount paid. Next, I want to talk about clearance applications. For many years, HMRC's Statement of Practice No. 1 of 1994 provided the only opportunity for an employer to seek clearance in advance of making a payment. Statement of Practice No. 1 of 1994 applies only to redundancy schemes. Other payments made on redundancy may not qualify for such clearance. However, HMRC has in recent years introduced a non-statutory business clearance option, which includes the option obtaining clearances on termination payments. HMRC says that clearance should not be requested until the scheme is finalised, so they won't deal with what-ifs. HMRC will provide written confirmation of its view on the income tax and NIC's treatment of a termination payment, and this can be very helpful to employers and advisors, especially where the income tax and NIC's treatment is not without doubt, or the client is concerned at the risk involved in making gross payment. Clearance applications are to be sent to the HMRC Clearances Team at Alexander House, 21 Victoria Avenue, Southend-on-Sea, in Essex. Postcode is S for Sugar, S for Sugar 99, 1 B for Baker, D for Donald. There is an email, hmrc.southendteam@hmrc.gsi.gov.uk, but be careful because large documents can be emailed to them. Large employers who have a customer relationship manager should make their clearance application to the customer relations manager and not to Southend. Now I want to look at the operation of pay as you earn and reporting requirements. Firstly, we have to remember it is the employer's responsibility to operate PAYE and deduct Class 1 NICs where deductions are required. Pay as you earn only applies to the cash element of the termination payment. If the payment is within the Section 401 exemption provisions, no tax will be deductible if the total payment does not exceed the £30,000 tax exemption limit. Where any part of the payment is liable to income tax, and payment is made on or before the date of termination of the employment, then deductions should be based on the existing tax code number, and we would have to include the payment on the leavers form P45, which most employers have to submit electronically anyway. Where the termination payment is made after the date of termination of the employment, code basic rate should be used, deducting income tax at the basic rate of 20%, and in accordance with the pay-as-you-earn regulations. In this situation, the employer should not include the payment on the form P45 and should not issue a second or amended P45 either. Payments within the Section 401 exemption provisions will not be earnings for Class 1 NIC purposes, and as I've already said, no Class 1 NICs are due and there is no exemption limit. Where a payment of earnings is made before the date of leave-in, the employer should deduct NICs in the usual way. If a payment of earnings is made after the date of leave-in and the termination of the employment, then a weekly earnings bracket would normally apply when calculating the Class 1 NICs. HMRC guidance can be found in the CWG2 Employer's Guide to PAYE and NICs at Chapter 5, Paragraph 135. The requirement to report termination packages only applies where tax is due on the excess over the £30,000 exemption limit. HMRC tells us there is no need to report cash-only packages, and there's no need to report mixed packages of less than £30,000, where it comes within Section 401. However, where the termination package exceeds £30,000 and includes non-cash benefits, perhaps medical insurance or the continued use of a company car, then a report should be made to HMRC by 6th of July after the tax year end. The employer may choose to report earlier, perhaps at the time the employee leaves and when the employer wants to provide details to the leaver. There is no prescribed form or format for the report, which could be a letter that should be copied to the employee. The information to be provided would include the total estimated value of the termination package, details of any cash payments and the cash equivalent of any non-cash benefits. HMRC will require an estimate of any future cash payments and benefits, and an estimate of the total lifetime package with details of the terms and types of future benefits. Again, for example, company car provided for 12 months, medical insurance provided until retirement date. A report may need to be made later to provide details of any variations in the package. Well, in summary, there has been a lot of media comment about termination packages, including MPs and civil servants and football managers, some of whom receive very large amounts of money. For AAT members advising their employers or clients about the income tax and Class 1 NIC treatment of termination payments, it can be quite a difficult as well as sensitive issue. Ideally, we should be consulted before the payments are made, and thus given the opportunity to review all the relevant documentation and the circumstances. In this way, we can properly advise and may also have the opportunity to seek HMRC clearance where the issue is not without doubt. The most important point to remember is that it is wrong to assume that a payment made on termination of the employment will be exempt up to the £30,000 limit. As I have discussed in this podcast, there are many questions about whether the proposed payment or any part of it is compensation or damages within Section 401, or whether it might be a contractual or other payment taxable under Section 62 or Section 225. We also need to remember that the NIC rules are not the same and that there are special rules for payments made after the date of cessation of the employment. I hope that this podcast will help guide you along what is sometimes a difficult road, and I thank you for taking the trouble to listen today.